Hello and welcome to the Crimespiracy Podcast. I just wanted everyone to know before this episode begins that our online forum at crimespiracy.com is open to all users. There, you can talk with all your fellow conspirators and detectives. Talk about old crimes, old conspiracies, new conspiracies, whatever you want. So go join now. It's free. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Crimespiracy. I am your host, Quentin.
And Shalene.
And today, we are going to be talking about the Enron scandal. And what are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about my man, Jim Jones.
Jim Jones.
Yeah, but first we got some talking topics.
Hell yeah.
First off, I just want to start out with what an idiot I am.
Why is that?
Because Reese, he didn't really bring a lunch to work today, and I got some Amazon packages in my house for him. So when he was on break, I went up there, and I dropped it off, and I brought him lunch. And I'm on my way home, and I take the same exact path home every single time. Whether I'm at his house, or I go up to see him when he's on break, or whatever. Same little path. And today, I zoned out while I was driving, and I stopped at the stop sign that I was supposed to turn at. I didn't turn. I went straight for, like, a whole two blocks.
Really?
Yeah. And I noticed, because I was like, I didn't know there was a bridge on this road. And I was like, wait a minute. I missed my turn.
That's really funny, actually.
And so then, just to make it even more shameful, I turned around in this person's driveway, I look into their backyard, and I make direct eye contact with two grown white men just drinking bars at the back of their pickup truck. And I turn around, and I go back the other way.
Jesus.
Yeah. Also, Animal Crossing is pretty cool. I've been playing it a lot recently, and by a lot, I mean a lot. Like, every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also today, oh my god, I finally finished a freaking art project, the graffiti project. I just finished redoing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did she say anything yet?
Yeah.
What'd she say?
I texted her.
By the way, guys, this project was due, like, probably, like, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, but I explained my situation of what was going on at the time, and she said that it was okay if I turned it in later.
Okay.
And so I sent her the pictures of it. This is what it looked like.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's all my stuffed animals, and then my name.
Mm-hmm. And graffiti.
And so the whole concept of the project was to do it in marker and then over it in colored pencil, right?
Yeah.
And I was
like, wait. Do it in like outline in marker and then the inside in colored pencil.
What?
Like the outline in marker and then the inside, like the colored part, is in colored pencil.
No, I thought it was do the whole thing in marker and then go over the whole thing in colored pencil.
So you drew the whole thing and with color with like Sharpies or like some other marker.
Mm-hmm.
And then went over the marker with colored pencil.
Yes, I did. The whole thing. Mind you, this is like a 3x2 foot piece of paper.
It's massive. That had to have taken you like 3 hours.
It took me 3 hours on just the name part. And then another 2 hours for all of the little creatures.
That's really funny. I'm sorry, but no, you just had to do the outline in Sharpie and then the
color. And it was so funny because I was like, sorry it took me so long. I had to get more colored pencils and then I had to get a sharpener and it was a mess. And she responded with colored pencil with two question marks and then you're crazy. That's a huge area for color pencil, but you rocked it. And I was like, yeah. What do you mean? Wasn't that the assignment?
Well, she said we could use like paint or like oil pastel.
We could have used paint.
Oil pastel.
If it was paint, I would have been done with it in like an hour tops.
I
know, yeah.
I didn't have any paint or else I would have done that because I did colored pencil too.
But I didn't go over it
in colored pencil.
Why didn't you tell me?
What, that we could use paint?
Yes. Because
the directions were very clear.
I didn't watch the video ever.
That's how you ended up doing like double the work.
Fair point.
We learn for next time.
Yeah. My mom's coming home from Florida today.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
Yeah, I kind of liked being home alone, but I also didn't at the same time.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, there's not a 6-year-old screaming and waking me up at 6 a.m. my mom's not to make breakfast at 7 a.m.
Yeah. Yeah,
You know, one time my mom decided that because she couldn't sleep, she was gonna vacuum at like 3:30 in the morning.
Why?
Who vacuums at 3:30 in the morning?
That's really unfortunate. I'm sorry. That's crazy talk.
Yeah. And then one time, I think this was last year, whatever, we've had multiple gas leaks in our house. And we've had to call the fire department multiple times to fix it.
Uh-huh.
And one of these times, I'm just chilling in bed. I'm just watching some YouTube. It's late at night. I don't care. And my mom comes in my room. She's like, Shalene, we got a gas leak. And she's like, get your shit together. We're going to Grandma's house.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to finish this video first. And my mom's like, get up there here. And I'm like, I don't have pants on yet. She was so mad.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
But, oh, yeah. By the way, guys, I know I said this last episode, but the vlog that we recorded where we get sushi, it will 100% be up by the time this episode goes up, at least the audio portion of this episode goes up. So keep a lookout for, well, I mean, go look for it, go watch it, leave
go
a like.
Go to youtube.com/conspiracy.
Yes, and watch our latest vlog, leave a like, subscribe, you know,
the drill. All that good shit.
Yeah.
All right, so today we got my boy Jimmy Jones. His name's not actually Jimmy, it's Jim. Just a
Jim.
Forewarning. So, his father was a World War I veteran, and he was just, like, living off of disability because he was in a gas attack.
Okay.
And it said that he was very emotionally just, like, not there at all. Like, he did not give a shit.
Mm.
And his mom was, like, definitely the weirdo on the block. Like, nobody wanted to be her friend. She was like, okay. And, for example, she didn't believe in different religions. She just believed in the sky god.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. And it's even said that she didn't want a child at all, but once Jim was born in 1931, they moved to Indiana. And then his mom, like, she pretty much worked every single moment that she could so that she didn't have to go home and see her son.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad. And then his dad was an alcoholic.
Oh.
And so,
a rough life.
Yeah, when Jim talked about his childhood, it was basically just, I raised myself and my parents don't give a shit about me. And so then on to high school. It said that Jim would wear, like, white press shirt, slacks, you know, his church clothes. You know, everybody would wear their nice clothes on Sunday to church.
Of course, of course.
But he wore it to school every single day.
Mm.
And, another fun thing is he carried a Bible around with him.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Man, you know, there's someone that goes to our school that's kind of like this. You know who I'm thinking about?
Andrew?
You were supposed to leak his name.
There are multiple Andrews. Andrew's a very common name.
Yeah, but everyone, everyone who knows, we'll cut that part. Well, I'll bleep it. But yeah, I'll bleep it every time you said it.
Sorry, Andrew.
He's creating more work for me?
Yes.
Nice.
Just wait, I'll say it later in the story too. You won't even expect it.
I probably, if you do that, I won't cut it out. And then he'll hunt your ass down.
That's scary. That is a scary thought.
Yeah, I know, dude. Don't freaking, look, don't fuck around.
Trench coat, briefcase and all.
Don't fuck around, man. Oh my god.
Okay, so little Jimmy boy, he formed a baseball team with the kids who like lived on his street. And he wasn't even good at sports. He was just good at like getting people together and leading them. Fun fact, this episode's about a cult, so makes sense.
There we go.
Yeah, so apparently in his free time, Jim would just like roam around and go to different churches to just like sit and listen, and he would just gather as much information as he could about all of the different religions and, you know, what one really felt right for him. And apparently he would even go out into places like shopping centers and like grocery stores and just preach the Bible. All of this is in high school too. So you imagine he's pretty popular.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So then he got a job at a hospital as a helper, and he did stuff like, you know, cleaning up vomit, patient accidents, or, you know, like amputated limbs and stuff. Apparently he just loved the hospital so much that he was set on becoming like a nurse or a doctor and going to school for it. And so while he was working at this hospital, he met Marceline, who also worked at the hospital, and, you know, they chatted, they became friends, and then she confessed her love to him because he was just such an amazing and considerate person who just cared about everybody so much.
Yeah.
And so they ended up dating, and they got married in 1949, which... so they're kind of young still.
Yeah.
And so Marceline, she thought Jim was a Christian. So once they got noticed, she was like, hey, this guy's kind of a weirdo.
Yeah.
And she realized that she wasn't completely, like, she wasn't aware of all of Jim's beliefs. And so they talked about it. And Jim straight up told her, he was like, I don't believe in the same God you do. And apparently they fought about it, like, a lot. And Marceline, she thought about, you know, filing for a divorce. But then again, it's the 50s. And that's like, oh, if she got divorced, then something's wrong with her, you know?
Yeah, it's not natural at that time. It was
very, very highly looked down upon.
Yeah, for sure.
And so she was like, all right, I'll stay with this weirdo guy.
If I have to.
Yeah. And so often Jim would take her to the African American churches in the city just because he was so drawn to them. And according to him, white churches were boring, and he just felt like he didn't want to be there. Jim liked how much the African American churches were like singing and dancing and just like really enjoying and getting into their worship. And Jim, when he found these churches, he was like, this is where I was meant to be.
Okay.
And
interesting.
Oh yeah. And so he joined one of these churches, and, you know, they immediately welcome him with open arms. They're like, ooh, yes, white man.
In the this is like the 40s, right?
This is the 50s. So this
is the
50s. Like,
okay, yeah. So
this is also pretty crazy that he's a white man and he's like openly going into like African American churches.
Yeah, for sure.
And so Jim, he actually became a student pastor at the age of 21 through this church. However, he became a little frustrated with, you know, how much they were telling him what to preach, and he just wanted to do it his way.
Oh, shit.
So he opens up his own church, and he begins his own preachings. His church involved a mix of Christianity, a little bit of New Age spirituality, and radical social justice. And, you know, all these things, they're actually, like, pretty good fucking things to go for.
Uh-huh.
And so he attracted a lot of people. And his church was also known for being racially integrated. So, okay. You know, again, 1950s, this was pretty whack at the time. But
yeah.
He was very, like, adamant about having everyone know that they were welcome in his church.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is really nice. Like, this doesn't seem like a cult story yet.
Yet.
So, his wife, Marceline, she kept track of, like, the scheduling and the financing, all the paperwork and stuff, while he was out there, you know, working his preaching powers with the people. And, you know, they became a power couple with this, and their church, it was just getting too big for their little building they had, and they had to look into expanding because they were gaining so many followers. And so the area that his church was in, it wasn't quite the best area, and the people living around, they didn't have a ton of money. So he wasn't just going to straight up ask them for money because he knew that they were already struggling. But he came up with a plan. He knew, he's like, God damn it, I gotta up my performance. He needed to wow the crowd, to perform miracles. You heard it here, folks, miracles. This son of a bitch. He began calling upon people in the audience and commanding people's headaches to vanish or coughs to cease. You know, he had to start small, so he could gain their trust. So, like, in the middle of church, he would just be like, healed by the power of God is granted through him. And this guy who had a headache didn't have a headache anymore.
Mm.
Because he used the power of God to heal him.
Or what we now know as the placebo effect.
Or him planting somebody in the audience.
Oh, that's what he did?
Yeah, he would plant people in the audience. So, you know, the people, they start talking. They're like, yo, this guy can perform miracles. And so then Jim, when those little collection plates start going around, he starts making some big bucks because he can perform miracles.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. So he'd upped his performance, gained more members, and he got that fat cash. And Jim, being the generous man he was, he would make guest appearances at other local churches to heal more people. So when he would go to these other churches, he would bring some friends, plant them in the audience, and then have them fake, like, an illness and heal them. And one of his friends, who wasn't announced as his friend, went up onto the stage, and he was, like, telling everybody about how Jim cured their heart defect.
Jesus.
Uh-huh. So eventually, he gradually, you know, moved his way from curing headaches and coughs to curing cancer. That's right. This man cured cancer with God. So, you know, with all this money that he was bringing in, he got a new building that could hold up to 700 people. And at first he called it Community Unity. But they had to change the name because the building that they were moving into already had the word temple carved into it. So they were like, let's just keep temple in it. And so then he renamed it the People's Temple.
Good God.
Yeah. Can't go through fixing that. You just gotta add to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, Jim made it his personal goal to integrate the African-American people into every, like, aspect of Indianapolis. He would gather groups of people going to local restaurants and, like, shops, then fighting for their equality. And by fighting, I mean peaceful protests. There was no violence in this yet. Mm. He started to gather people from his church, and he, you know, began these peaceful protests until the owners finally gave in, and they were like, oh, I guess we'll serve the African-American people. I mean, if we have to. But then, old Jimmy boy comes in, and Jim's like, ayo, owner guy. If you go with this and you allow these people into your shop, that's more money for you. And I'm going to tell all my church people to go to your store if you go with this. And Jim was basically promising them tons of money with new customers if they, you know, went along with this. And so once they did, Jim would hand out flyers to his members, and they would have a list of restaurants and shops who supported them in their culture, you know, as equally as everybody else's. And these businesses began, you know, they were making some fat stacks. Because everybody was like, oh shit, equality, go in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so these protests with Jim and his church members, they continue. And Jim has presented himself as the voice of reason. That's his title. And then in 1965, Jim and his wife, Marceline, they moved to California with their three kids. They have three kids, but they are not involved in the story at all. I just thought I'd include them because...
Why not?
And so they started a new church out in California. And 50 to 60 people actually, like, followed them out there to be with the church.
Why did he move in the first place?
Just
moved.
I don't know the reason.
They didn't say?
No. So then 4 years go by, 1969, the church isn't as popular as Jim would have liked, and his marriage is kind of starting to go down the gutter. They have four children now, one biological, the other three are adopted, and, you know, Jim being so focused on the church, and Marceline, you know, as a mother would be focused on the children, they, you know, grew apart a little bit. And then Jim had an affair with one of his young church fangirls.
Yikes.
So he's a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Like, he's legit, like, preaching about how bad adultery is and how you should never cheat on your spouse. Then he was like, hey, yo, don't tell my wife, though.
Good God. This is what God wanted.
Yeah, this is what God wanted. And so then he starts thinking, and he's like, shit, I can't let the people find out about this.
Yeah.
My career will be done for. And so he goes and he tells his wife, and... It's also really sad because right at this current time, his wife is having, like, serious back issues, and she's bedridden most of the time. And so Jim, he comes up with this genius idea. He comes up with this whole story, and he's talking to his wife, who is bedridden in pain. And he's like, since you're not able to sexually satisfy me anymore, I've got her.
Yikes.
And, oh, man. And it's also, like, she has to agree because they've moved. She has nobody else there for her. He and the church are, like, her whole life. Like, she doesn't even have anybody to go back to. She can't get divorced. So she just has to stay with him.
Yeah.
And so... So he goes and he tells the church about what's going on. And he's like, hey, everybody... God's good. So 19-year-olds up top.
Yeah.
I saw that in the informational video I was watching, and I thought it was so funny I had to include it, but it's not my joke. As much as I would love it to be. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Dude, my water tried sliding away on me.
I mean, you got some mega friggin'
dude, it's possessed,
reflexes there.
Did you say I have mega reflexes?
Mega reflexes.
This is going, like, slower than a snail.
God, okay.
Oh my God. Okay, so you know, he tells the church about his wife's condition and his affair, and the church supports him. All the people are like, yeah, affairs!
Nice.
Fuck your wife! And, you know. Alright, so, you know, 1970 rolls around. They got a pretty good gathering of people. You know, he kept doing his miracles. He starts to sell pictures of himself for $5 a piece. Not $5 in today's money, $5 in 1970 money. Like, god damn, who's gonna pay $5 for a picture of a preacher?
All his little worshiplings.
Worshiplings?
Yeah.
His little frogs in trench coats?
Yeah, his little frogs in trench coats. Exactly.
And, so with all the people at his church, he wouldn't, you know, he'd start collecting people's information on, like, the little cards that they wrote in. And he would start mailing people pamphlets and asking for donations through the mail and such. And so they were getting some cash. And they started to open up stores. But they were still, like, he's so wholesome still throughout this whole thing. Like, the stores that he opened up are basically thrift stores. And it's just people donate their secondhand things and then they resell them to people who, you know, need it. And Jim even used some of this money to bring up, like, scholarships and stuff. And help pay for kids to go to school. And even went as far as to buy houses and turn them into dormitories for these kids to live in while they attended free college.
That's pretty cool.
I want that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Free college? Hell yeah. So the people of the church, they apparently had the mentality that, you know, if you don't agree with us, we'll convince you. And then if we can't convince you, you are the enemy. And so Jim, he began getting a little more mean and controlling over his people. He even went as far as prohibiting them from doing things like going to the movies. Because, God, why are you spending money on anything but the fucking church?
Exactly.
How stupid people.
How dare they?
Yeah. So Jim, he's like, I'm gonna buy some buses. And so him and his people, they would go on their little route to other churches and they would heal more people. And so once his church got big enough, he would call out a random person from the crowd, you there! And he would announce that they had an unknown cancer that they were unaware of and that he was going to heal them of it. And so a nurse would go out into the crowd and she was like, they would go up and they would swab the inside of the person's mouth, you know, to test them for it. But when they were swabbing their mouth, they would drop a piece of chicken liver or something into the back of their throat. And then, of course, they're going to, like, hack it up. And that's when Jim is yelling about how that little gob was the cancer and that he spit it out and that he's cured because he coughed up the cancer.
Dude, this guy is really, like, smart.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, crazy. Like, how much planning he had to go through.
Oh, just you fucking wait.
It gets crazier.
This is chump change compared to the other shit we're going to get into.
Good God.
So, you know, year later, 1971, drugs. He becomes massive druggie. He uses all sorts of stuff during the day to give him a little boost, and he takes a little something at night to help him go night-night. So, he was able to get all of this stuff like so easily because of all of his followers. He'd be like, hey yo Susie, you give me that good shit, and they're like, hell yeah, I got you Jim. and they would just give him prescriptions.
That is crazy.
And He also said that it was pretty easy to hide it from the other followers, because he would literally just wear dark sunglasses 24/7 to cover up his red watery eyes. And once it got pretty serious, he became a lot more mean and psychotic, and you know, people were starting to get a little concerned, like, "Ayo, why are you wearing sunglasses inside?" And get this, he tells them, he's like, "Guys, I gotta wear these sunglasses because I am so close to God that the heavenly light escapes my eyes sometimes, and I have to keep these sunglasses on so I don't burn you." And they believed it.
That is so freaking crazy.
And they believed it.
That's so crazy, dude.
What?
My God.
So to continue, the church members would call Jim and Marceline fucking mom and dad, and they were all so close-knit, and Jim would, like, even though they had all of this money, he was always putting it back into the church, and they still had very, like, average things for their home, and they bought all their clothes and stuff secondhand from their own stores, and he was never, like, flaunting the money that he had. He was always like, "Oh, we're one in the same."
So it was more about the control of these people than it was, like,
for like, his own benefit. Like, he was like, "Look at this great connection we have. We have the same stuff."
Yeah, he just, like,
"We're both poor." No, we're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, along with Jim's drug increase, so did his amount of affairs with other women. He thoroughly believed that every single woman was attracted to him and wanted him.
Like Trisha Paytas? With every guy?
Yeah.
Just like her?
And even at one point, almost all of the women in, like, his inner circle had become a sexual partner at one point.
Damn.
Yeah. So he kept advancing for things for the church, and he was looking for a place that he could call the Promised Land. So this is a place where him and his followers could live safely without having to worry about the CIA or the FBI. Because for some reason, he thinks that they're after him.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So he finds this place, Guyana in South America. So you would either get there by boat from Miami to this place, or you could go, like, by plane, but they didn't really have airports.
Okay.
It was, like, a real small place, very small population. Most of it was, like, fucking forests. There were, like, no roads. And so Jim, He was telling his followers about how great this place is gonna be, and that this is the place where they could avoid martial law and concentration camps that would soon take over America.
Jesus.
Concentration camps.
Man.
And, you know, because they knew all of this information about what was gonna happen, the FBI and the CIA, they were all going to be slaughtered and killed if they didn't run away to this Promised Land. And so Jonestown became a thing in 1977. They had, you know, little cottages for people trying to live in it. But, you know, that kind of wasn't enough for the hundreds of people who followed him.
Damn, hundreds.
Hundreds of people. Why?
Because they were brainwashed, my guy.
Yeah. So, Jim, he just basically wants to have control over everything about these people's lives. For example, if someone wanted to be in a relationship with someone or end a relationship with someone in this town, they had to ask Jim and get his permission. all mail was opened first and read to make sure it was acceptable before giving it to the person it was sent to.
So this guy was just a dictator, pretty much.
Yes. If something was sent out of this town and back into the United States to, like, their family, it had to be only good things about Jonestown. If there was anything bad, they were forced to rewrite the letter and then send it once it was acceptable.
Damn.
Yeah. So, mind you, these are cottages, a couple cottages with hundreds of people. So these cottages are overcrowded to all hell, and people kept showing up. They had limited water, and when people were showering, they were told to keep their mouths shut because it wasn't safe to drink.
Mm.
Yeah. But good old Jimmy boy, he was like, oh, man, what am I going to do over here with my generator, fans, lights, maybe a little fridge, an intercom. Jesus. He had an intercom in his house so that he could announce things to the whole town without leaving his bedroom.
Wow.
Yeah. And get this, the whole thing was funded by the people's social fucking security checks.
Oh, man.
The whole thing was funded by their social security checks.
So it was a bunch of old people.
What the fuck? Even with these hundreds of people's social security checks, they didn't have enough money for anything. The people began carving little wooden toys of, like, trains and cars that they sell and raise some money so that they had enough money to eat. And even then, the whole town was living off peanut butter and jellies, and they drank water and Kool-Aid because it was inexpensive and they could mix the Kool-Aid with the water to make it last longer. But oh boy, were Sundays a treat. Guess what you got on Sundays? A cookie. You got a cookie on Sundays.
Shit.
Because Jimmy was real nice. And then another thing about how great it is if you broke any of the rules that he had, you were segregated from the rest of the group and you were forced to run everywhere. You had to eat and sleep and, like, shower away from the others. And you weren't allowed to look or speak to anyone. So much for equality.
So they were just, like, shunned completely.
Yeah.
Man.
So, at this point, Jonestown has over 900 people. And they all go to these, like, nightly meetings about stuff Jim has literally made the fuck up. And these meetings would go on till, like, 2 or 3 in the morning. Probably the drugs. That Jim was taking.
Yeah.
It's like, how could you go on for that long about stuff that you made up?
That's probably how he developed the schizophrenia that had them move there in the first place. It was, like, drug-induced.
Probably. So the people wanted to leave. Everyone. I mean, who wouldn't hate being stuffed in a cottage, eating only peanut butter and jellies, and drinking Kool-Aid?
Yeah.
But the only thing is, Jim had all of the money, and these people had no free will.
Yeah.
Those who wanted to leave had to pay for it themselves, and since they were selling, like, just these little toys, they barely had enough money to eat.
Yeah.
And even then, Jim had everybody's passports and, like, papers. So, like, there were some people who got enough money and, like, left, but Jim made them sign a paper that was basically, like, you can't say anything bad about this place ever.
Oh, like an NDA.
Yeah. But then Jim was like, hey, baby, the CIA coming after us. And so Jim, he was like, he was thinking, and he's like, God damn, the only way we can escape the CIA from storming our town, slaughtering everyone, is guess what? Can't get killed if you kill yourself first, am I right?
Yeah.
And so everybody, you know, Jim brings out these big gallons of this strange dark liquid, and everybody bottoms up. And then Jim's like, haha, motherfuckers, it was just a test to see if you would die for me.
God.
What? And yeah, so this was just Jim's test to see how much control he really had over these people. And after this, he was like, oh, buddy boy.
Yeah.
Guess what we doing now? So, finally, someone's family member back in the U.S. was getting concerned, and they got the police involved, and they were like, ayo, my family is in this place, Jonestown, and they're being held against their will, and there's abuse and stuff. And so this senator guy, Leo something something, arrived March 17th. Today's March 19th.
Just a couple days ago.
Whoa. And, you know, Jim immediately was like, everybody put on your best fucking behavior. It's like when your mom takes you out into the grocery store.
Yeah.
As a child. Yeah, that's this situation.
Mm.
So, this guy goes in there, and he's like, man, everything seems kind of alright. But then, once he went to leave, where it really gets going. So, some of the people were like, okay, give me a ride. Give me a ride to the U.S. Get me in your plane, I swear to God. And he's like, yeah, I'll give you a ride. But the security that was watching over the Jonestown people were so brainwashed that they were like, this guy's a part of the CIA. And these good people are being kidnapped. And they're going to be murdered.
Yeah.
So then the security pulls out their guns and they start shooting at their car. The car ends up getting away. Everybody's alive. But then they get to the airstrip. Security had followed him, kills everyone. Oh. Absolutely everyone. The congressman, the involved press, even the Jonestown people. And so then the security, they go back and they tell Jim, they're like, hey, yeah, we killed the bad guys for you. And Jim was like, no. He was like, you exposed us, goddammit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Jim finds out, and, you know, him being the genius he is, he immediately comes up with another story. And he gets on the intercom with his followers for their nightly meeting. And he's like, all right, guys, that plane that this Leo guy is on, somebody's going to take it. They're going to take it over. They're going to crash, and they're going to blame it on us. And then the military is going to come after us. We're all going to be executed. We got to go now. And so then Jim's like, now is time to drink the potion in order to save the children from becoming slaves and the seniors from execution. And he also made the statement that they were not committing suicide. They were performing a revolutionary act. What? Okay. So the next day, the defense troops went to Jonestown. Everybody's dead. Everybody's dead. Some people had drank the potion, and others had an injection mark on their bodies, which was thought to be because they didn't want to die, and they were held down and forced to take it. And then Jim and one of his mistresses were found center stage, and the only ones who died from gunshots and not the poison. Because, you know, it's less painful.
Yeah.
And so, when they finally counted everybody who had passed, a total of 909 bodies. And 409 of those 909... were never identified.
Man.
Because of things like, they'd been in this place so long that the dentist didn't have their dental records right anymore. They couldn't be identified that way. And because it's in South America, the heat, the humidity, their bodies were decomposing so fast that they didn't have time, even though it was only like a week.
Yeah.
And then while they were searching, you know, Jim's cabin, they found $700,000 in cash in suitcases.
Why?
I don't know. What was he doing with $700,000?
Yeah, when his people were dying. I mean, Shay, he probably didn't care about him.
He didn't care,
so
obviously.
I wonder if he actually believed that they were going to die.
Probably.
And then maybe this was like an escape plan. You reckon?
Probably. But anyways, the police, or, you know, the military or the government, whatever, they took this money and they ended up giving it to the families of those who had lost people.
Oh, okay.
You know, because of that faggot Jim.
I have to bleep that out now.
I realize that I shouldn't say these things after I say them.
I'm going to forget. You have to remind me. Apologize to all the people that might have been offended by that word.
I mean, I'm gay too, so I don't mean any offense by it. I mean offense to Jim, but not offense to those in the LGBTQ plus community. I love you guys. You're my homies. I just don't like Jim.
Jesus Christ.
Fun fact, because we're at the end of my part of the episode. All of, like, Jim's story, that last bit, and all of those deaths are actually on a tape that you can find online and listen to.
Oh, really?
You can listen to these people die.
Well, he recorded it.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They taped all of their nightly meetings.
Hmm. All right. That was pretty freaking crazy.
Yeah.
So, if you guys didn't notice my hat, or when I said at the beginning of the episode, I'm going to be doing the Great Enron Scandal.
Enron.
Yes. Everyone who lived during the 90s definitely knows what Enron is. The company was created as a result of a merger between two smaller regional companies, InterNorth and Houston Natural Gas. Most people remember this company having booming success through the 90s and then crashing into the ground in the early 2000s. But very few actually know what happened, so I'm going to explain it. So, the 90s. The decade between the 90s and 2000s, with help from Enron's new cash cow CEO Jeffrey Skilling, Enron kind of did a switcheroo in its business practices.
A switcheroo?
Uh-huh. Instead of dealing in the ordinary energy production area, which they were originally intended, which the merger was basically for, they started to invest heavily in overseas energy companies, which made Enron more of a massive investment firm instead of just the normal energy production. And they also started to invest in broadband internet services at the time. It was a newer thing, so they were dipping their toes in the water. So here's where Enron's real scandals begin. Skilling introduced Enron to mark-to-market accounting in 1991. So essentially, if a company makes a deal with another company that is projected to earn them $100 million, they can write down in their books that they made $100 million the same day that they made the deal, even though they have not earned a single penny. See what I'm saying?
What?
Okay, so...
No, I'm just saying what, because that doesn't make fucking sense.
It was a thing that they used to do, and it wasn't... It was... I don't think it was illegal, but it was definitely, like, fraudulent. So instead of... So they made a deal with some company for $100 million, and the same day that they made the deal, since it was projected for them to earn $100 million, they just wrote down in their books $100 million earned, even though they haven't made anything yet. And the thing is, even if the deal fell through, they still reported it as they actually made money.
What?
So.
No, I get it.
But why?
That's crazy.
Yeah. it's pretty crazy. Like, I mean, it was pretty smart. So these deals typically didn't include exact numbers and how much they would make Enron. So this just gave Enron room to make up any random high number that they wanted, and they would report it. So basically, this means that every year they were reporting that they were making almost double what they had made the previous year. So their stock kept going up and up, because they're reporting on making millions and millions of dollars. Now, this company, at its highest, was bigger than, like, Apple at this point. Like, their stock was massive. They were the biggest. Everyone was talking about them. Like, everyone knew what it was.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So all throughout the 90s, Enron was losing massive amounts of money. Like, hundreds of millions to billions of dollars they were losing. Although they were reporting earnings, they were actually in the negative.
Oh, Jesus.
They were losing money. Enron poured billions of dollars into a natural gas project in India that fell through mega. India couldn't afford the prices of the electricity, which meant that this massive electric plant that Enron had just built in India was completely profitless. Now, thanks to mark-to-market accounting, they were able to flip the scenario upside down, reporting a massive profit. Enron executives enjoyed their massive bonuses.
Oh, my God.
Bethany McLean, a reporter for Fortune, which is the organization that creates the infamous Fortune 500 list every year, she was doing a story on Enron where she landed herself in a phone call with Jeffrey Skilling, the CEO of Enron at the time. She naturally started to ask very simple questions, such as, how is Enron earning all this money? So, of course, Skilling, drowning in scandal after scandal, told her he wasn't sure because he wasn't an accountant. So he set her up with a meeting with the CFO of Enron, Andy Fastow. Andy Fastow was a pretty slimy individual described as having no moral compass.
Slimy.
As the CFO, he moved all of Enron's liabilities over to subsidiaries to make it look like Enron wasn't losing any money, nor did they have any liabilities. So once the Skilling and Fastow realized their shenanigans wouldn't last forever, they moved to a new money-making scheme. Enron merged with Pacific Gas and Electric. Although PGE just operated in Oregon, they had the ability to move into the great state of California. So naturally, Enron took them there. Shortly after the merger and Enron's capture of California's electric grid, California experienced relentless blackouts. No one knew at the time why this was happening, because Enron was more than capable of producing enough electricity to power the entire state, plus more. It was soon found that Enron was moving electricity in and out of the state to manipulate the prices of electricity.
What?
They had employees working around the clock to squeeze every last nickel and dime out of Californians. This was heavily fraudulent. However, the state couldn't do anything about it since it was a federal problem. So, essentially, they had these people working in the Enron HQ that would take energy out of California and move it into a different state, so the energy prices in California would go up because of supply and demand, which would cause blackouts because they didn't have enough. And then eventually, once people were paying more, then the energy moved back to California and just kept on happening and made electricity prices skyrocket, which was earning them major, major money.
Jesus.
So the state of California, like I said, couldn't do anything about it because it was a federal problem. Enron had a massive political backing. It was basically because Skilling, the CEO, was best friends with President Bush. Well, not best friends, but pretty much best friends with President Bush. So this meant Enron could do whatever they wanted with the people of California, and the government pretty much just stood back.
They were like, ha ha.
So the Senate finally intervened. However, this whole scandal ended up costing California upwards of $50 billion in damages. But one good thing did come out of this. Since the people of California turned against their governor, they elected someone they thought would do a better job. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Isn't that crazy?
Jesus.
He came out of this whole thing. That's how he got elected. So, the fall of Enron. Skilling resigned one day out of the blue in 2001. Kenneth Lay, who was one of the founders of Enron, stepped down from his position on the board to take over the CEO role. A single day later, an accountant that worked for Enron, by the name of Sharon Watkins, sent a letter to Kenneth Lay detailing all of the corruption and scandals she had watched Enron participate in over the years that she had worked there. The Wall Street Journal wrote a paper questioning the legality of Enron, and this later led to the SEC launching an official investigation into the dealings of Enron. Investigators started to feel nervous. However, the months leading up to Enron's collapse, Skilling worked on convincing his employees to invest their life savings into Enron stock. However, in the background, Skilling and all of the other Enron executives were offloading their stock rapidly due to the hellstorm that was about to come. So, yeah. They kept telling their employees to invest in all their stock, buy it all up. And then in the background, they were selling all theirs because they knew what was about to happen. Enron had his accounting firm shred literal tons of paper documents that would have easily put Enron under. Like, literal tons. Like tons of paper.
Like metric tons?
Like metric tons.
Jesus.
Like multiple tons of paper. Yeah. Some of Enron's top executives ended up having criminal investigation launched to investigate their cooperation in Enron's corruption. All at one time, 21,000 people at Enron lost their jobs and health insurance with a severance package of only $4,500.
Oh.
Yeah. They just, boom, done. So at the end, Kenneth Lay, he was facing up to 40 years in prison, but he died of a heart attack 1 month before his sentencing.
That bastard.
Yeah. And then Skilling was sentenced to 24 years in prison and $180 million in fines. He ended up only serving 12 years and was actually released in early 2019. Now he is plotting his return to corporate America.
Well, now the people know.
Yeah, now they know. But there was some investor that pulled out in 99. And he made a lot of money, but since he pulled out so early, the government couldn't do anything about it. And so now he's taking the Skilling guy under his wing. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
Oh my goodness.
So I rate this conspiracy 10 out of 10 tinfoil hats. I mean, it's not really a conspiracy, but like I rate the scandal a 10 out of 10 tinfoil hats.
Cause I will 9 frogs in a trench coat. Because It is very interesting
how they're able to do all this.
Yeah, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. But the only thing is how involved it is with, like, you know.
How involved it is in what? Like, the world?
Yeah.
Like, how involved it is in people's lives, especially, like, currently.
No, I mean, like, the more politics, like, that sort of corner.
Oh, I see what you mean.
I don't like politics at all. This is too much adult for me.
I see. I think it's very interesting, and I don't know. I think it's really, really cool. Not cool. Obviously, a lot of people suffered, but I just think it's a really neat story.
It is a very cool story.
So, yeah, that has been episode 22. Of Crimespiracy. Thank you all very much for listening.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yes. The video version of this podcast should be up around Saturday. The following Saturday, after you watch this episode or listen to it on whatever podcast thing you listen to it on. We're on. I wanted to see where our Crimespiracy, like when we look at ourselves up on Google, where we come up. Mm-hmm. And like, what came up was like all of our podcasts, but like it was like Google Podcasts, and there was like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and then there was like all these other like different like services that I had never heard of that were on.
Really?
Yeah, like just random ass services that I know I didn't put our podcast on, and we're just on it. So it's really interesting. So literally whatever podcast thing you want to listen to us on, go right ahead. Again, that has been episode 22 of Crimespiracy. Thank you all very much for watching, and we will see you next time.